You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. The Michigan legislature is scheduled to take a final vote today on a bill that would create a 24/7 telephone referral system connecting callers in mental health crisis to service providers. But what about people who might be too frightened or just buried in pain to ask for help? Dr. Eric Atches may be on to a new method to detect risk of suicide written in the body. He's an associate professor and director of psychiatry at Michigan State and also works at Pine Rest Christian Mental Health Services. Dr. Atches, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
How did you become interested in what the body can tell us about our mental state?
Well, I think for many, many years, clinicians who have been helping individuals with depression and suicidal thoughts have used the best tools that we had available. So we would ask people about how they were doing, how their mood was. We would ask them if there were any stressful events that had occurred recently. And then we would do our best estimate, our best clinical judgment, to try to assess whether someone was at high risk or medium risk or low risk, and what we could do to be of help to them.
And yet that system has its fallacies.
Yeah, it has its strengths and its weaknesses. You know, we certainly know that recent stressors, such as the loss of relationship, the loss of a job, any other sort of crisis that comes up, health problems, all put somebody at increased risk for depression and even suicidal thoughts or behavior. But we also think that there are clues in nature that would indicate that there are biological underpinnings that may also put someone at heightened risk. When we look at other areas of nature, it seems that there are other examples of infections leading to what might be considered suicidal behavior. So, for example, in rats who are infected with a parasite called toxoplasmosis, the parasite affects their brain in such a way that they no longer fear cat urine.
Whoa.
So then they're more likely to be eaten by a cat, and the cat is the definitive host for the parasite. You could argue that this parasite is inducing the mouse toward a suicidal activity. Another example is in ants, actually. So there is another parasite called a lancet liver fluke, which can get into the brains of ants, and it takes over their navigational system, and they actually will climb to the top of a blade of grass, attach themselves to the top of the blade of grass at night in the hopes, well, I guess, I don't know if it's in the hopes, the conscious hopes, but that a grazing animal will then eat the ant, and then the parasite will then go into the feces of the grazing animal and be dispersed that way.
We might say that these animals are showing behaviors that are acting strongly against their best interests.
That's right. Absolutely. And so if there are conditions that affect humans in the same way, whether it's inflammation caused by all sorts of different things, I mean, we want to try to understand that so that we can best guard against it and we can best treat it.
Just curious, I mean, are those behaviors necessarily on par with human suicidal ideation?
You know, I don't think so. You know, given our cognition, given our metaphysical, way of thinking about things are different. I mean, I think our forebrains are much more developed. There's lots of ways in which the behavior of ants and rats are different than humans. But I think it does point to the validity of the concept that there could be some sort of insult to the brain or the central nervous system that is very biological in origin, that can lead to complex behaviors that are not in our best interest, as you say.
What do we know, for example, about how the brain looks at times when people are at a heightened risk for suicide?
Well, the area that we've been investigating is to find out whether different conditions that lead to inflammation in the body, so it could be in the body, it could be in the brain, may then transfer to the brain and put somebody at increased risk. So, for example, we have evidence that individuals who have increased infections, so they may be acute infections, things like bacterial infections, or they may be more chronic infections where you have actually a parasite that's been in your body, or if you have an autoimmune response where there's increased inflammation in the body, those may also put somebody at heightened risk. And so we wanted to try to study that and understand, could this provide an additional data point that would help us stratify risk for people? We talk about all the other areas in medicine where we have blood tests. For example, if you have diabetes, we check your blood sugar. If you have high blood pressure, we check your blood pressure. And we need more of those types of objective measures as we assess depression and suicidality in particular.
The study that you're working on takes that information about the brain and then goes one step further. How did you start to focus on ways that the blood can look different for people who are going through this?
Right. The original studies were actually done in individuals who had a lumbar puncture. You know, we kind of think of that as a spinal tap. And what investigators in Sweden actually found, my colleague Lena Brunden at the Van Andel Institute, was that there's increased inflammation in the cerebrospinal fluid, which encircles and bathes the brain. And so based on that, we knew that inflammation could have an important role in worsening depression and suicidal thoughts and behavior. And then the question was, well, how can we make this clinically useful? You know, individuals at risk for depression aren't necessarily going to want to have a lumbar puncture when they go to see their doctor, but they might be willing to have a blood test. So the next step in the investigation was to look whether there were links that we could detect in the bloodstream. And it turned out that there were. So we and others have identified a number of inflammatory factors that have been linked now to worsening depression and suicidal thoughts and actions. Those are things like different interleukins, C-reactive protein, tumor necrosis factor alpha, a number of these markers that seem to track with increased suicide risk and depressive thoughts.
Are any of these markers associated with other kinds of illnesses too?
They are. I mean, there are many conditions that can cause inflammation in the body. So, you know, we talk about things like multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis, even seasonal allergies can sometimes lead to increased inflammation in the body. And we think that in susceptible individuals, that may worsen their depression or worsen their suicidal thoughts or behavior.
Hmm. The study that you're working on at Pine Rest right now, will you tell us a little bit about how it's designed, what you're looking for?
Sure. One of the next steps that we think we need to take is to determine the longitudinal relationship between these markers and depressive symptoms and suicidal thoughts and behavior. So in previous studies, most of the relationships have been cross-sectional in nature, where we essentially take a snapshot of someone's inflammatory biomarkers and then assess their depression and suicidal thinking. In this new study, we'll actually be following those markers and suicidal thoughts and behavior and depressive thoughts and behavior over a period of 1 year. And that'll allow us to see if any of these biomarkers track with worsening depression and track with worsening suicidal thoughts, and whether they may in fact predict worsening depression or worsening suicidal thoughts. So that's the, I think, the really important aspect of this next study. So what we will do in the study is we'll recruit 160 individuals, half of whom have depression and half of whom have depression with suicidal thoughts and actions. And then we will follow them over the course of a year and measure at 8 different time points, both their blood biomarkers, but then also a comprehensive assessment of causes of inflammation, symptoms of worsening depression, and then suicidal thoughts and actions. And we hope that by doing that over time, again, we'll be able to more closely assess whether these biomarkers could potentially have predictive value and clinical value in assessing suicide risk.
Are all the subjects in the study male?
No, men and women. It's adults, age 18 to 65, men and women.
I wondered also if the data might look any different for young people, if that's an area that you would expect to mirror these results, or, you know, possibly might be something that needs study further on.
Yeah, I mean, I think there will be certain subsets of individuals who will have different biomarker profiles potentially. So, for example, we did a study recently in women with postpartum depression. And again, this was a cross-sectional analysis, but we found that some of the biomarkers that had been elevated in other studies were different in women with postpartum depression. And the hope then, of course, is to tailor treatments that can be personalized for an individual depending on their type of depression. If they have an inflammatory depression, perhaps we need to use anti-inflammatory treatments to better control their symptoms.
You know, it might be scary for some people to think about a blood test sending them onto a watch list. No matter how the study turns out, how do you envision this kind of information being used in the future?
The way to think about this is one more data point that helps inform decision making. When we assess suicide risk, we are also assessing protective factors, things like family support, whether somebody has had good premorbid functioning, are they in treatment, are they getting help? Those are all things that go into the kind of the calculus of whether someone is at high risk or not. So I think of blood or biomarkers as being one more potentially useful data point to help doctors and clinicians better assess that risk and better help people get the treatment they need. You know, so for example, if you have severe depression, we want to help you get treatment for that. And especially if it's an inflammatory type of depression, we want to be able to treat that in a way that makes sense. The flip side, of course, is that if somebody is at lower risk or if there are significant protective factors, even if the blood test is elevated, it doesn't necessarily mean that somebody needs to come into a hospital for treatment. They may still be able to access treatment through their outpatient doctor or an outpatient facility.
Dr. Atchis, thank you for your work on this.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for giving us the time to talk about it.
Dr. Eric Atchis is an associate professor and director of psychiatry and behavioral health at Michigan State, and he also works at Pinerest Christian Mental Health Services, where the study we've been talking about is taking place.